This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today, and we have a lot on our plate today. We're going to start with what's been your standout moment of the year.
Brad from Louisville. My take on 2013 is my wife and I had our first baby. It was born prematurely, but it came through in the NICU after 3 weeks. Then baby was home for 4 days. I broke my ankle playing basketball after work. And after 6 weeks, it's still broken, but I was able to get back to work just in time for Christmas.
Our number is 8778-MY-TAKE to share the moment that stood out for you. Like Brad, it could be something personal, or you might pick something from the news that really resonated with you this year. But here's another standout moment from the year.
What kind of world will we live in if the United States of America sees a dictator brazenly violate international law with poison gas, and we choose to look the other way?
The president there asking the question in early September. And 3 months later, an answer can perhaps be found on the streets of Aleppo in northern Syria, where government forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad have been dropping not chemical weapons, but particularly deadly barrel bombs for more than a week now. The killing is indiscriminate, as many as 500 people dead, including dozens of children. In just a moment, we'll consider the calls from some that whatever the world thinks of Bashar al-Assad, the time has come to negotiate with him. First, Reese Ehrlich has just returned from Damascus as a special correspondent for the Global Post. He's also the lead author on a series of special reports for the Global Post called The Land of Cain and Abel. He says the perceived stability of President Bashar al-Assad's regime is looking better to many Syrians, and if neither side is seen to be winning, then for the time being, that suits Assad just fine.
It's probably the best he can hope for at the moment because the rebels are strong militarily in the north of the country. Basically, they control a number of northern cities and then in the south as well. So it's really a contested fighting in the middle. Politically, he does have support among Christians and Alawites and other minorities who are convinced that the rebels are all extremists and that Assad offers the best hope for some kind of stable secular government, even if it is a dictatorship. The Sunni majority are very much opposed to Assad, and they form the basis for the recruitment for the rebels.
Now, you mentioned that the rebels hold a lot of territory in the north and in the south, and the makeup of the rebel ranks has become really troublesome for the United States. We're hearing more and more reports that it is, in fact, extremist groups, Islamist groups, Al-Qaeda sympathizing groups that have really wrested influence from, for instance, the Free Syrian Army, and that they're the ones really running the show now on the rebel side.
Yes, there's no question that the extremist rebel groups have gotten stronger militarily. They don't necessarily have more popular support. In fact, when they do take over cities and impose their extremist view of Sharia law, they become quite unpopular. But they have the guns and they have the backing from Saudi Arabia and other wealthy Gulf states. It's very interesting. The U.S. was supposed to be arming and supporting moderate rebels, but once the guns and the material gets inside Syria, it can go in any of many directions. And some of the extremist groups are seen armed with U.S.-supplied weapons. They recently captured a depot chock full of U.S. vehicles and arms and ammunition that had been held by the Free Syrian Army, the so-called moderates. So on the ground, these extremist folks operating with the excuse of bringing Islam to the country are on the rise.
So as the United States then looks towards this conflict and the difficult situation on the rebel side, Reese Ehrlich, what do you think is the best course for the United States right now? We've heard scarcely little from the White House and the State Department about Syria lately. And I guess from what you're describing, that makes sense. There's not a lot of good news to report or even any clear strategy here.
Well, they have a strategy. The problem is it hasn't worked. They tried the old strategy that supposedly worked in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is find a strong man who's pro-U.S., proclaim him a Democrat and the country an emerging democracy, and hope people go for it. Well, they couldn't find somebody who has a popular base in Syria. I think the best thing the U.S. can do is not interfere in Syria and urge other countries, including Saudi Arabia and Russia and others, to do the same. People of Syria have to settle this on their own. It's very complicated. It's probably not going to end anytime soon. but possible peace negotiations coming up in January might make some steps forward. The people of Syria have got to resolve this themselves.
At this point, Reese Ehrlich, the stated United States policy stated by the president himself several times is that no matter how this turns out, Bashar al-Assad must go. The president has said that almost verbatim. Is there a foreseeable outcome at this point where that's the case, where the war comes to an end and Assad is no longer president?
I think in the short run, that's highly unlikely. Assad has enough support within the military that he's going to stay in power. But there could be a sudden change. The rebels are strong militarily. Their people within the regime could decide that they want to survive without Assad and possibly make compromises with the rebels. And that's ultimately, there's got to be a political settlement, something along those lines.
Reese Ehrlich has just returned from Damascus as special correspondent for the Global Post, and he's lead author on a series of special reports for the Global Post called The Land of Cain and Abel. Reese, thank you.
Thank you.
So, as we just heard there from Reese Ehrlich, he says ultimately there has to be a political settlement of some kind in Syria. But there are lots of unanswered questions in Syria and lots of doubts. Will parties even turn up to peace talks in Geneva? Do we have a State Department that sees anything except least worst options? Earlier this month, former U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker told our partner, The New York Times, that the U.S. needs to start talking to the Assad regime. For Crocker, talking to Assad is, quote, the least worst option, just like I just mentioned. Mona Yacoubian, a senior advisor at the Stimson Center's Middle East program, where she focuses on peace and stability in Syria. Hello, Mona.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well. I want to ask you specifically about the prospect of negotiating with the Assad regime in a moment. But first, coming to the end of the year, it has been a horrible year in Syria. I wanted to get your assessment of the last year of that war, where we stand now versus where we stood or thought we could come from in January 2013.
Well, I think you are absolutely correct. It has been a horrific year for Syria. There are now 2.2 million refugees. Overall, a third of the country's population has been displaced. The death toll has more than doubled. We've seen the reemergence of diseases like polio. And of course, we've seen the growing influence of jihadist elements inside the country. And so it has been an extraordinarily bad year for Syria.
You mentioned that last point, the growing influence of jihadists, and it brings us to the main point here that's troubling for a lot of Americans who are paying attention to this conflict. There is a military stalemate. The rebels are powerful in many areas of the country, as Reese Ehrlich just said, but not the rebels that we want. Jihadists are doing a lot better than the Free Syrian Army, who seems to have been marginalized. What do you think about this situation? Is it time for us to negotiate with Assad?
Well, I think it's absolutely correct that we're seeing growing influence on the ground of extremist elements, both jihadists as well as even those beyond jihadists, Salafists, who also call for a more extreme version of Islam. I don't think Assad, though, is going to be part of the solution to this problem. I think Assad still remains part of the problem. So I think the challenge is working with international actors to try and figure out how in the short term to de-escalate the situation inside Syria, whether it's through negotiating ceasefires, gaining humanitarian access for the many civilians that are suffering. But ultimately, I can't sign on to the notion that Assad is going to be part of the solution. He may have some durability, that's clear. But I don't see Assad long-term reigning over all of Syria.
On the other hand, Mona Yacoubian, as you're well aware, a lot of people who are observing this conflict closely say it can no longer be about getting rid of Assad. It has to be about preventing the rise of jihadism in Syria and preventing it from becoming a haven like Afghanistan was.
Well, again, I would agree that the conflict is now evolving and we're seeing more increasingly counterterrorism concerns rising to the fore, certainly in this country. But again, I think you have to understand the root of the conflict. And here, I think that Assad, his presence is helping to perpetuate the rise of jihadists. That said, I would also agree that I don't think his ouster is coming anytime soon. And I also don't agree that there's a military solution to this.
Well, Mona Yacoubian, it makes me wonder if a negotiated settlement is the only way forward. Is there a way forward to the United States stated goal that eventually Assad must go. And I guess it makes me wonder if the new cooperation we have with Iran on the nuclear issue might be an avenue towards some level of cooperation in Syria.
I think it could. I do believe that a negotiated solution, a political solution to Syria, really is the only viable option. We've seen no appetite for military intervention in this country or elsewhere internationally. And so I think ultimately what needs to happen is a resolution that preserves some aspects of the current government, but that also, of course, brings in opposition elements as well. And here I think Iran and Russia both can play an important role. In addition, it's going to be very important to bring key regional players such as Saudi Arabia and Iran into discussions where all key players agree that the solution going forward for Syria is one of de-escalation and gradual transition. I think it's important to distinguish between Assad and those immediately around him and then the broader sort of security and military apparatus in Syria. Assad, I think, in my opinion, is unsalvageable. But I think ultimately for there to be stability in Syria, there will need to be some preservation of government structures and a process which brings opposition elements into the government as well.
Mona Yacoubian, Assad is unsalvageable, and a lot of people agree with you. But he's still there and shows no signs of going anywhere. And it points me back a year, just to end our discussion. Missed opportunities. What opportunities has the West missed over 2013 that could have made this gone differently, if any?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. And it may well be that Syria is such a complex and difficult problem that there really are no easy or workable options. I continue to believe that the answer has always been one of diplomacy. So I think that perhaps much earlier on, a much more invigorated diplomatic process. I also think that much more should have done and needs to be done with respect to humanitarian access and providing more resources to the many Syrian civilians who are suffering.
2013 has been a devastating year in Syria, and we're looking forward to 2014 with possible new strategies, a new way forward, and a lot of questions in Syria. Mona Yacoubian, senior advisor for the Stimson Center's Middle East program, where she focuses on Syria. Mona, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, coming up, we'll have the latest on why many thousands are likely to be without power for the holidays. The situation is particularly bad in Michigan. And from the same part of the country, a push to restore the city of Detroit using the written word. Former poet laureate Billy Collins joins us to discuss the Write a House nonprofit that welcomes working writers into the city with the hopes that they'll stay. And some fair warning, it's Christmas Eve, as you know. We're talking about the Christmas songs that we love and a few that we hate. Randy Brooks, the man who gave us Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer 35 years ago, is here. But for all the holiday schmaltz, a reminder that this holiday has also given us some true classics, and we also have some of our favorites from here on The Takeaway. Here's my favorite, one of my favorites, 1977, The Starman, David Bowie, with some other guy.
When we come, every child must be made.
Let's go to Detroit now, where there's no doubt they've had a tough year. Looking forward, though, in the next few months, saving Detroit will become about a lot more than fixing its finances. Part of this restoration project will be about fixing its exterior, repairing the damage and decay that's an easy target for the news media, who often see only what's broken and busted in Detroit. But here's one idea that could be transformative. It puts people back into some of the city's many vacant homes with the idea of turning the city into a mini writer's colony. Write a House is an organization that aims to teach and support literary creativity. And now they're launching a contest where a panel of judges will review work submitted by low-income writers. The winners of the contest will be given newly remodeled homes in Detroit for at least 2 years, and after that, they'll be given the deed. Billy Collins, former poet laureate of the United States, will be one of the Write a House judges when the nonprofit starts accepting applications from working writers later in the spring, and he joins me now. Hi, Billy.
Hi there.
It's very good to have you on this interesting project. And the first question is why Detroit? I mean, I guess they could use the help.
Detroit, unfortunately, has become a kind of symbol of urban failure, urban. I mean, I think it is the first major city to officially declare itself bankrupt. But also, it's not just Detroit, of course. I mean, there's economic problems in every major city these days. But I think the genius behind this program, well, we'll see if he's a genius when this starts getting underway. But is Toby Barlow, who is a native of Detroit, so he's launched this program in order to save his own city. So he's kind of personally invested in this project as a native of Detroit.
What kind of writer do you think the program is hoping to attract?
I would say as a literary person myself, we're looking for writers with a certain degree of talent, of course. But we're also looking for writers who they don't have to be from Detroit, by the way. They could be here. They could be from anywhere in the country or from Sweden, for example. But we're looking for people who would commit in a way to Detroit to become citizens of Detroit and to give Detroit a kind of infusion, not of money, but of talent and of committed creative people.
And Billy Collins, it makes me wonder how many writers the program can hope to attract. If it's one or two or three, that's half a block of maybe rebirth for a block in Detroit. It's a long way from transforming a city, not to be a pessimist.
Well, true enough, but it has great symbolic value. It has great buzz because it's such an original idea. And it also, you know, if we think about the broken window theory, that as we all know, that if there's a broken window that's not repaired in a building, the rest of the building gets destroyed and the neighborhood starts to fall down. So it's this kind of terrible domino effect. Well, Write a House is sort of a fix-a-window project, you might say. The hope is that it would reverse that project. And a few restored homes on a block might become contagious. It might attract other buyers to the neighborhood. It might stabilize the neighborhood. I mean, the reason I'm attracted to this, full disclosure, by the way, Toby Barlow is something of a pal of mine. But the real reason I'm attracted to this is I just think it's such a wild and daring offer, you know, that usually a writer will be offered a 2-week residency at a writer's colony. Or if you win a prize as a writer, you might get a little money, $1,000 or whatever. But here you're actually going to be given a house. Here are the keys. You know, I mean, there is, as you say, there's a 2-year kind of rental agreement. But if you pass the 2-year test and you're a steady citizen and you take care of the house and all that, you're given the deed. Here are the keys. So here's an actual house you can live in for the rest of your life if you want.
Well, Billy Collins is somebody who's spent his life in literature, former poet laureate of the United States itself. I want to step back for a second from one house or two houses or five. Can literature save a city, do you think?
Well, no. I mean, quite frankly, I mean, there is a kind of Joan of Arc romanticism about some program like that. But it's a start. It's a move in the right direction. It's lighting a candle and not cursing the darkness. And it also, I think, because of its wildness, it's kind of sprezzatura, as the Italians would say. The idea of giving a house to a writer and fixing it up, and Toby's, I think, was to kind of paint the houses in wild color so they would stand out in the neighborhood. But it's a start. As I said, it could spread. I'm not sure it can save an entire city, but it's better than doing nothing.
And Billy Collins, as long as the writers are in the houses, how about you guys give him an agent at the end of the 2 years?
an agent.
Or maybe a meeting with a publisher.
Well, that's something we could work into the program. First, they get a roof over their heads and a quiet place to write, and then we'll take them to New York and fix them up with an agent.
A new project called Write a House hopes to install low-income writers in Detroit, a city that has had a terrible, terrible year and could use a way forward. Billy Collins, former poet laureate of the United States, will be one of the judges on the panel for Write a House. Billy Collins, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well, it might be a bright and merry Christmas for most of the country, but for 280,000 people in Michigan, it's looking pretty dark, literally. An icy blast of freezing rain has hit the state, along with parts of eastern Canada, turning off streetlights and leaving hundreds of thousands without power. Michigan's largest utilities say tree icing and downed lines may prevent the power from being restored for days. Joining us now from Detroit is Quinn Kleinfelter, senior news editor for WDET Radio. Hi, Quinn.
Hello.
Well, what does it look like in Detroit and the surrounding areas there?
It's pretty, but it's also pretty bad. The ice, as you say, has hit power lines. It's hit trees, caused a lot of problems. If you get like a quarter inch of ice on things, that can cause a lot of difficulties. It added extra on over the last few days to where you've got maybe a half inch of ice on, and that brings power lines and trees down immediately. There's lots of workers from across the country and trying to get the things put back together. But at the moment, it's kind of a race to try to get people set up, hopefully, by Christmas Eve and into Christmas Day. But at the moment, it's still a struggle to try to get power on for hundreds of thousands of customers.
What is the weather outlook for the next day or two? We would hate to see a situation where repairs are just beset by more downed power lines.
Yeah, it's iffy. There could be more coming. There was a slight warming trend, but that might be after Christmas. And it's really putting places to the test. It's the largest Christmas week storm in about 126-year history of some of the utilities. Largest storm they've seen for sure in the last decade. And places like the American Red Cross are being stretched as well. I mean, this is a time where they're always doing a lot of things for the holidays in any event. Now they've had to put up a lot of people in places like middle schools and shelters. They're running out of showers. Some of the showers are not actually working for some of these people. And so they're concerned not only about hygiene, but also about food spoilage. You know, this is one time where people have all those great holiday meals. And a lot of them were even in the midst of preparing them a day or two ahead of time. You know, when you're trying to get to grandma's house, you want to have all that set up ahead of time. And a lot of that, they had to switch to candlelight just to see what they were doing. The food, you don't know what's going to happen when your power's out.
Sure. Well, we mentioned about 280,000 people without power. But Quinn Kleinfelter, you were mentioning people in shelters around the area. Do we have a sense of how many people have been displaced from their homes because it's just too cold to stay there, and how many might be spending Christmas in a shelter like that?
Yeah, hundreds of thousands for sure around the state of Michigan. There was maybe 150,000 that lost power immediately after the weekend storms hit, and then there was additional ice on top of that, brought it up to probably a total of 300,000 by the time it hit the height. The probably hardest hit area in Michigan is Genesee County, where the city of Flint is at. There's still probably 60,000 or so people there that remain without power. There's shelters set up by the American Red Cross. Mobile food trucks have been trying to provide meals to people. You don't know about whether or not their holiday meals they were preparing are even going to be able to survive, but at least they're trying to get food to these people so they can have something to eat.
Has there been a federal disaster declaration or a response from FEMA or from Washington?
Not that I've heard of at the moment, although you never know if it's going to be a shifting situation. Lots of people that have been displaced, they're being taken care of. You know, also the travel to the area is a little bit touchy. The roads for a couple of days, many of them were just ice covered. At Detroit Metropolitan Airport, a jet slipped off the runway into the grass nearby. No injuries. That happened yesterday. So even travel, getting to the area in some places is treacherous.
All right. Authorities across Michigan, in Detroit and the surrounding area, dealing with some devastating weather and ice storms, some 280,000 people displaced. Quinn Kleinfelter, senior news editor from WDET, watching the situation for us. Quinn, thank you.
Thank you, Todd. Stay dry and ice free.
And you too. It's around this time of year that we look back at the year that was, look forward to the year ahead, but right now, look up. The Boeing 747 once ruled the skies. They were the most popular passenger airplanes in the world, romanticized as a way to travel and a way to escape in style.
Some of the most romantic hideaways in all the world are only hours away in a Boeing jetliner.
But that era may now be coming to an end. At the time of the 747's launch in 1969, airports were asking for bigger planes because more and more Americans wanted to fly. Boeing responded with the 747, a massive plane with two decks and an in-flight lounge that could be reached by a spiral staircase. But today's demand for the 747 is a far cry away from those beginnings. This year, Boeing received a total of 5 new orders for the plane. Carolyn Adolph is economics reporter for member station KUOW in Seattle, and she documented the rise and fall of the aircraft that was once called Queen of the Skies. She told me why the 747 may now be headed for a soft landing.
Turns out it's too big and it's too heavy. Those 4 engines that used to be so perfect for those movies where one of the engines would stop working and another one and you still had 2 and then you could go down to 1 and you could still fly. Those engines weigh a lot, and airlines are increasingly demanding fuel economy, and they really prefer a 2-engined plane. And the other thing is it's got a lot of seats, and airlines are preferring to not have that kind of pressure, having to sell all of those tickets for every single flight. So smaller planes just are selling more.
Now, Carolyn Adolph, you spoke to a fellow named Barry Latter. Who is Barry Latter?
Barry Latter is an engineer who came from Britain in the 1960s, and he was one of the original engineers on the 747. So back in the mid-60s, he immigrated here to help build this plane.
So my wife and I and one son at that time came here to Seattle on the 3rd of January of 1966. I had the privilege of working with that program for the next 12 years.
Does this mean that you were one of the Incredibles?
Absolutely.
Carolyn Adolph, what's an Incredible down at Boeing?
An Incredible is being part of that original team of guys who were working night and day for years to get this plane developed. Remember, people didn't know before the 747 was built that you could build this big of a plane. And Boeing managers, they would walk guys out to their cars and say, look, go home and just go home and get some rest. And these guys would drive around the block, maybe park and sleep somewhere, but then drive right back and get back to work. So they were on fire to build this plane.
And Barry Latter told you a story that really kind of got into my visual memory. Anybody who's driven on I-5 outside of Seattle past Boeing headquarters and that test runway there can relate to this statement that Barry Latter gave you.
People were stopped. They'd parked their cars on the side of the freeway and they were looking down at the airplane saying, you know, something this big can't fly.
Well, it sure did fly, not just physically, but economically for Boeing, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there was a time when we couldn't pop planes out of the factory door fast enough here to feed world demand. It was a highly successful plane, and it completely changed people's ideas about how they could live because they could travel suddenly to so many more places, and the ticket prices were affordable.
Carolyn Adolph, before I let you go, look, I cover Washington, D.C. I have for years. Air Force One is a 747. Air Force One has to be a Boeing 747. You can't picture it being anything else.
Well, you know, and it's this is it. Boeing is not saying it's abandoning this line. It's just saying that, hey, in the last year, we only made 5 of these planes. And we have a new plane, the 777X, which looks like it's going to be very successful because it's that one notch smaller. But no, I mean, the Air Force One is a 4-engine plane because the Secret Service really is comfortable with that idea. So that leaves 2 planes they can buy, a 747 or the French plane, the Airbus 380.
I have a pretty good idea which one they better go with, Carolyn Adolph. Redundancy is what the Secret Service calls for. And Boeing getting some redundancy, hopefully, to replace the magical, the mythical 747, starting to go into the twilight of its career. Economics reporter Carolyn Adolph from KUOW in Seattle. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work.
Also, dude, Chinaman is not the preferred nomenclature. Asian American, please.
Actually, it's pronounced Milwaukee, which is Algonquin for the good land.
Check out the big brain on bread.
Whether you are spending Christmas opening gifts and sitting under the stockings or eating Chinese food with your family, you're probably going to want to go to the movies, or at least you should. And that's why we've got our movie date team here in the studio, Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer, to tell us all about a couple of big blockbuster films. In addition to hosting the Movie Date podcast, Rafer is film critic for Newsday. Kristen is our culture producer here at The Takeaway. Hi, guys.
Hi, Todd. Hi, Todd.
As always, you can subscribe to their podcast at moviedatepodcast.org. Guys, we've got The Wolf of Wall Street, Leonardo DiCaprio, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. We've got a boxing flick called Grudge Match, and 47 Ronin, starring Keanu Reeves. We've got a whole bunch of movies out. Now, first, trivia. We have Keanu trivia since we have 47 Ronin, his new Asian martial arts action flick, I should call it. I guess that's accurate. Listen to this old Keanu Reeves clip. Now, this is not a Keanu Reeves clip, but a movie that he was in from early in his career. Can you identify this movie? Don't answer yet.
Jamie is bad, damn it. And there's nothing that we can do to save her. Now, I happen to like Jamie.
All right, just keep that in mind. Don't answer yet. That's an old Keanu Reeves movie from early in his career. True fans know it. Now, let's turn to The Wolf of Wall Street. Rafer, you've seen this movie. This is Leonardo DiCaprio. I've heard some complaints that this movie doesn't get to what the real problems with Wall Street and the downfall really were, the real hubris, but... I think that's
somewhat accurate. You know, Leonardo DiCaprio plays Jordan Belfort, who is a real-life financial fraudster on Long Island. He ran a boiler room called Stratton Oakmont. And he was known for his hard-partying ways and heavy drug use, very famous for that. I do think one problem with this film, even though it's, I would say it's kind of the raunchiest and maybe the funniest film that Scorsese has made, I do think that Belfort is kind of the wrong poster boy for the problems that we're going through now. He was more of a con man and a criminal. He's not part of the bank system that kind of brought around the collapse in 2008. So it seems a little bit off target to me.
The fact that a lot of went wrong was actually legal, if not unethical.
Exactly.
The Wolf of Wall Street. We also have The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. Listen.
The ice, Jace. She moves like a woman. I'm Walter Mitty.
Cheryl. Mel Hoff.
Where have you been?
Testing the limits of the human spirit.
I'd like to climb your hair and test that out.
Ben Stiller, Kristen Wiig. Kristen, I did not know that Sean Penn was in this movie.
Sean Penn is in it. Shirley MacLaine is in it. Star-packed. It's a wonderful, I'm putting it on my top 10 movies for the year. Rafer's glaring at me right now. I can see. It's a wonderful, optimistic adventure about going from living in the fantasies of your head but not living in real life to really embracing life and taking it and going to all the limits that you can. Really push. Rafer's just glaring at me
Rafer's
right now.
Rafer's punching his teeth.
I thought it was a tone-deaf disaster. I thought the movie got everything wrong there was to get wrong. It's soggy. It's sentimental. It just misses the mark over and over. It forgets it's a comedy halfway through. It forgets it's about the secret life of Walter Mitty halfway through and becomes a gallivanting, globe-hopping adventure. It just made no sense to me.
Adventure.
No sense.
Well, it's the best when we have stark disagreement because that means everybody has to maybe see it and see whether they're on Team Rafer or Team Kristen. Guys, Grudge Match is a buddy boxing flick with great actors, De Niro and also Sylvester Stallone. Alan Arkin's in it, so I was kind of intrigued by the trailer. Let's listen for a second.
Hey, what are you doing?
I thought you wanted me to hit this.
What are you doing? You're going to beat up the meat? That's not sanitary.
No, we're just here to buy a little dinner. You don't have to punch everything.
Rocky reference, beating up the meat carcasses. I have a hard time believing this could possibly be good, Rafer, but...
Yeah, you're correct about that. Yeah, there's a lot of Rocky references, a few Raging Bull references because of De Niro, of course. Raging Bull, not really a comedy, doesn't really fit into the movie that
not
well.
Not so much.
And I also think there's a little something weird about seeing these two guys at the end of the film hit each other in the head. They're both over 60, and De Niro in particular looks a little fragile getting knocked around by Stallone, and it makes you think of the medical implications instead of concentrating on the comedy and the fun.
Kristen, in the posters, both Stallone and De Niro are pretty buff, but that has to be Photoshopped.
It looks a little Photoshopped, and you know, I have to agree with Rafer on this movie. It is a little sad to see these older guys punching each other out. There are a couple of mildly funny moments when they're actually promoting the fight, but I think the promoting the fight moments aren't enough to carry you through the whole thing.
Can't say that I'm surprised that I can't be carried through that film. I did like the funny lines in the trailer, but I assume that that's about as far as it goes. Although Alan Arkin, it's hard to turn away from him sometimes. Well, it's Keanu time. 47 Ronin. We've seen Keanu all over television promoting his latest martial arts effort. Now, the guy was in Matrix. He knows how to throw a punch and a kick. Let's listen to Keanu.
Rivers of blood and mountains of corpses will not stand in our way. Find your envy and hatred, and I will give you all you desire.
Well, I think I heard Keanu breathing in the Keanu way, but that was not his voice.
That's actually not Keanu. that's Rinko Kikuchi playing the witch in this movie. It's a twist on the old Japanese legend about the masterless samurai who avenge the death of their master. It's got a really good Japanese support cast, but I think the whole movie is a little dreary and not as fun as it could be.
Kristen?
I thought it started off with a bang. I was actually laughing my head off. I thought this was going to be good, campy fun, but sadly, unfortunately, it really starts to drag about 10 minutes in, and then it just gets slower and slower and slower until you're asleep at the end.
All right. Well, Kristen, because you're flesh and blood and you're a regular human, you think Keanu Reeves is just totally dreamy.
Oh, he is so handsome.
And we all get that. And that's why we have very special Keanu trivia. Now, we just reviewed 47 Ronin. I asked you to listen to a clip of a 1986 movie from early in Keanu's career. Let's listen again, Vince.
You don't understand a damn thing, do you? Jamie is bad, damn it. And there's nothing that we can do to save her. Now, I happen to like Jamie. But John is still alive. Don't you see that?
And who's next on his list?
Now, that was not Keanu Reeves. That was his co-star Crispin Glover.
River's Edge?
River's Edge.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Rafer, you totally got it.
Guys, that's movies. I knew Rafer might get that one. Kristen, I have to say, I knew you probably did. Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer, don't forget to download their movie podcast at moviedatepodcast.org. to get the latest on your holiday movies, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
I'll be home for Christmas.
It's that time of year again. Wherever you go, whether you like it or not, lots and lots of Christmas songs are playing. Some of them are quite dreamy and pleasant, like that one. Hi, Bing. Sorry we slighted you earlier in the show, but you were on with David Bowie. That's the way it goes. Not all of them are quite as listenable as our friend Bing Crosby there. There are lots and lots of holiday songs out there that no matter how hard you try, you just can't like them. And there are others that are just really memorable, great one-hit wonders, like this one. Listen.
Grandma got run over by a reindeer. Walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe.
Be honest, you're bobbing your head right now, and you know the words. And good for you that we have Randy Brooks with us. Exactly 35 years ago this month, Randy Brooks wrote that song, Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. It's a holiday song that has sold an estimated 40 million copies worldwide, even outselling classics like White Christmas in some years. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Todd.
40 million, really?
I don't know. I don't know. But it's been on so many different compilation albums, you know, and been included in so many different toys. It's kind of hard to keep track.
A simple little song. Everybody knows it. I mean, I've known that song ever since I was the tiniest kid. How did it become such a hit from just something you sat down and wrote to being a mega hit?
You know, if I could recreate it, I would be doing it every year. Elmo and Patsy heard me sing it in a bar. They decided to record it to sell from the stage, and a friend of theirs took it into San Francisco and gave it to a disc jockey. He put it on the radio, and I guess because it was so unusual, the phone rang off the hook with people saying, please don't ever play that again.
Yeah.
But a number of other people called and said, please play it again. My husband was at work, and I'd like him to hear it. And it caused enough controversy that the San Francisco Chronicle wrote a big half-page article about it, and that got picked up by the wire services, and really the news sort of drove this song.
Well, you know, as I was growing up, Randy, and I heard this song, I always kind of liked it because it was just a little bit naughty and kind of cynical. It sort of turns Christmas on its head a little bit. It's not bad, but it's a little violent, and it's not all tinsel and Rudolph noses. I always got the feeling that you might have been a little bit cynical about something when you wrote this song.
You know, I wrote this song in reaction to a Merle Haggard song called Grandma's Christmas Card. And on Merle's song, before I even got to the end of the thing, I thought it was going to be one of those country songs where they make you fall in love with a beloved relative for two verses and then they kill them off in the third verse. And I thought it would just be more honest if country music would start admitting that the relative was dead at the beginning of the song and then still come up with three verses and a chorus. So that was just an exercise that I set out for myself. And the song was filled with punchlines because I intended to get laughs in a bar with it. I certainly never intended for it to be played on the radio or for children to hear it.
And there was no denying from the start that indeed Grandma didn't survive her confrontation. Well, Randy, while we have you here, we have a whole bunch of other songs that we wanted to run by you. And some of them are what are disparagingly perhaps called one-hit wonders. But since you sort of have one, even though you're 40 million strong, we wanted to run this one by you. Here is Ray Allen, Sam Salzberg, and Wandra Merrill, Dominic the Christmas Donkey.
Hey, jingety-jing, it's Dominic the Donkey. Jingety-jing, it's Harry Christmas Donkey.
Randy Brooks, I heard a rumor that you don't actually hate this song.
I don't. It's one of those things to me that is so bad that it's funny in its badness, you know. I'd never heard this song until it appeared on a compilation album from a radio station in New York that Grandma was also on. And I thought, what does this have to do with Christmas at all? But it just made me laugh.
Okay, well, if you don't hate that one, let me try this one on you, if I might.
Okay.
I want a hippopotamus for Christmas. Only a hippopotamus will do.
Randy Brooks, say something good about that song if you can.
It made somebody some money.
You reached for it. Yeah, you just gets under your skin, huh? That's Hippopotamus for Christmas, written by John Rocks, performed by Gayla Peavy, who was 10 years old at the time in 1953.
And I always thought it was somebody just sounding like a little girl.
Got their voice sped up nonetheless. Well, look, while we're on the high-voiced little kids singing Christmas songs, you know, when I was a kid, we loved the Chipmunks. At least I kind of did, I admit. They did record a popular Christmas song. You know what's coming, folks. If you can't stand a Chipmunk Christmas, guard your ears, because here it is.
Christmas, Christmas time is near.
Randy, I don't think they sold 40 million, but they've sold millions of copies of that one.
When I was in the fifth grade, that was the only thing I asked for Christmas. I loved that song.
An inspiration for you, apparently.
Apparently so. And it was the same guy recording under a different name, I think, who had recorded Witch Doctor, which was another favorite novelty song of mine back then.
The great Eartha Kitt did a Christmas song that was a big hit for her. Now, she had other hits. This was probably her biggest. Somebody will correct me if I'm wrong. We're going to veer away from the annoying to just the very, very popular. Not a bad one here. Listen.
Santa baby, slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, and hurry down the chimney tonight.
Well, Randy, I don't know if she was exactly a one-hit wonder, but it was a big hit for her.
It was. A little raunchy, and that doesn't bother me at all.
What do you think of the song?
It's clever. I like it. I don't know that it should be in heavy rotation at Christmas time, but I do enjoy it.
Well, here's one that was in heavy rotation, Randy. Here's Bobby Sherman. Listen.
I saw Mommy kissing Santa Claus underneath the mistletoe last night.
There you go, Randy Brooks. Randy Brooks, our last one.
Catchy. Always liked that one.
Yeah. I always liked it too, but it didn't sell 40 million copies, and it wasn't a mega hit like Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. Randy Brooks, writer of Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer 35 years ago and 40 million copies ago. Thanks so much for taking us through Christmas.
Todd, my pleasure. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. Well, after all those songs, we think that you need a chaser. So another takeaway favorite. Listen to Tom Waits.
Your virgin mother and child. Holy infant, so tender and mild.
Tom Waits, Silent Night, and Christmas Card from a Hooker in Minneapolis. We're asking you, what are the moments that stood out for you this year from North Augusta, South Carolina? The moment I realized I was probably dying. I had double pneumonia, survived, obviously, never missing that flu shot again. And from Fort Lauderdale, being given an airline ticket for my birthday so I could go see my 2-year-old grandchild in California. That was the moment from this year. We want to hear from you, 877-8-MY-TAKE. What was your standout moment of 2013? Share your story with us, also on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Merry Christmas. This is The Takeaway.
I could have been someone.
Well, so could anyone. You took my dreams from me.
I kept them with me, babe. I put them with my own. Can't make it all alone. I built my dreams around you.
The boys of the NYPD chorus will soon go away, babe.
And the bells are ringing out for Christmas Day.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.